Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today our guest is Abdi Noor Iftin, author of Call Me American, a memoir published just last week by Alfred Knopf. This book is the story of a miracle, a series of miracles, set against a backdrop of pain, suffering, and horror. Abdi fell in love with America as a child. He learned English from Arnold Schwarzenegger and Michael Jackson, Bruce Willis, and Sylvester Stallone. When the first waves of U.S. Marines landed in Mogadishu to take on the cruel and lawless warlords, Abdi was one of the first to cheer the arrival of those heroes that he recognized from the movies. He was wearing American clothes, knew American dance moves, and even took on American as his surname. Then the Americans left, radical Shabab took over, and Western culture was forbidden, and things became deadly once again. Abdi, through a series of fortuitous and really incredible coincidences and twists of fate, made his way to America. It's much more interesting and enlightening to hear how all this happened through his voice. So welcome, Abdi, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So after all this time, do you still feel that it was a miracle that you were able to make this incredible journey?
I think it's partly a miracle and partly a perseverance and a dedication and a faith and a spirit that I had grown up. I think it's the combination of all of that, because it couldn't have only been a miracle. You know, if I would do nothing either in Kenya or in Somalia. And what I'm trying to say right now is that growing up in a civil war as a child, you know, holding hands with my mother and, you know, praying for death, because life has been very, very painful. But then there was a window out of Somalia into the world, and the only world that my eyes could see was none other than the United States. And thanks to the Marines that came to Mogadishu, and thanks to the movies that I went to, and thanks to this wonderful icons and people that were in the movies, or that the Marines that were jogging or, you know, in their uniforms and the streets of Mogadishu, to me that was miracle, right? That was miracle. Like, how, you know, why are these people in here, and they seem wonderful? So I think that my longing or need to become like those people, and then making it work, not giving up, and going through extremely difficult time in Somalia, where power had been shifted from warlord to very, very fundamental Islamic terrorists, same as ISIS, you know, who, if you speak English, they would, finish you off, you know, kill you for doing that. Working with a girlfriend, I had been beaten so badly for just doing that. And I had been called not to keep the nickname, my favorite nickname, American. And I think I didn't give up, right? When I say perseverance and dedication, it's just that I have been given a warning and a notice to not do anything. And technically, they were trying to get me drop everything else but follow the only way that the Islamic terrorists have been interested in. But to me, it was, I wasn't at a place where I felt I had been overwhelmed. I had been possessed by the things about America and everything about America. And, teaching myself English, many years sitting at that, movie theater, which was just a shack, little TV, you know, television screen sitting on a table. I did not want all those efforts to go wasted. You know, I just knew that I could do something. That was the thing. I believed that even though I didn't have any family member in the United States or anywhere in the Western world who could ever send us a dollar, and there were so many Somalis at the time that had family members in the U.S., and they really survived with the dollar and the money that had been sent, but they had no respect and appreciation for America more than I did. To me, it was just more than, you know, it was just madness that I had to completely ignore things that my mom was saying, things that my madrasa teacher was saying, which is completely crazy, right? Doing that in Mogadishu, it's, you know, your family can disown you, your neighbors can, you know, hate you and all of that, and I did not care. So that's the dedication and the experience and the faith that I had. And then I think at some point, you know, because I had prayed in English, and I had been praying for years, and I got to know some Americans. I arrived in Kenya, and somehow America was still too far away, and at some point America was unreachable to me, because the refugee process was never happening, and then there you go. You know, the miracle happened when I won the diversity lottery. That did not need an effort except a few cents that I had paid to the internet that day. And then it was a miracle. All my friends had not been selected. I had been selected to process U.S. visa. And then again, the struggle was real. It took me a year and a half, you know, to go through the everything else that I needed. And I went to the interview, and I had not been approved somehow, you know.
Right.
The Americans probably were not reading my heart, but there's thousands and thousands of Somali refugees in urban Kenya and in the camps in Kenya, and America has accepted some of those and had denied a lot of those people, and they were probably thinking I was pretty much the same person, except when all the friends that I had in the United States started writing recommendation letters and support letters, and even U.S. senators that got involved and all of that. And I think the embassy was somehow, you know, had their jaws dropped and was like, who is this guy, you know, someone who has never been to the United States but still had all this support. So that's, I think, my, I dream big. I've been really, really fighting to get to this point where I would want to come to the United States. And then it was a combination of miracle and a perseverance,
yeah,
and a not giving up on my dreams.
Yeah, it's like my dad always said, you know, you make your own luck, and if you're not willing to work really hard, if luck knocks at your door and you sit on your bed and you don't answer it, you're not going to get to America. And
exactly.
You were fighting for it. You know, I got tons of questions about the book, but one that's always intrigued me is, when you did arrive here, was America the same America that you had dreamed of, the movies you had watched, what you had read, what you'd heard from the Marines when you landed here? Was it like you thought? I know the donuts weren't, but was the country like what you thought it would be?
No, not at all. America was never the same. And trust me, I kissed the runway at the airport, and everyone else was pouring out, and people seemed bored and all of that. And to me, America, you know, there were so many short Americans, you know, tiny people running around, and you know, these are not like the same people that I have seen on the movie. But America was never the same, because the night that I landed at Logan Airport in Boston, two things happened. A young black African-American was shot and killed in Missouri, and his name was Michael Brown. And it was a breaking news. It was all over the television in, you know, at the airport. And then there was a movement that was starting the same evening that I landed. And this movement was called Black Lives Matter.
Wow.
And, you know, ever since from that day, I found myself in the middle of this war where, you know, I had been struggling to reinvent my identification, because I wanted to be an American. Unfortunately, I ended up becoming a black person where I have never identified myself as black, even in Kenya, not even in Somalia. In Somalia, I identified myself as an American. Hmm. Funny thing, even though my parents identified themselves as tribes, but coming to America, the American adjective was not there anymore. I mean, people have either been Caucasian or black, and the Black Lives Matter happened, and there were violent demonstrations happening all over the country, and I ended up coming to Maine, one of the whitest states, you know, in the U.S., and when I went to Starbucks or Dunkin' Donuts, because I have been so open to starting a conversation with people, and things they talked about was they just asked me about my feelings towards what's happening in the country, and they said, "We're so sorry, and we feel so bad," and then the friends that I had, you know, started telling me, you know, Abdi, we're here for you. You know, the cops are killing black people, but stay safe. And whenever I went out, I received a text message on my cell phone saying, are you safe? Is everything okay? So, no, America was never the same. I had been shocked. I never received the peaceful, wonderful, you know, great America that I really wanted to live, the America that everyone... the same, you know. I thought that Eddie Murphy with Will Smith and Sylvester Stallone and you know, and Bruce Willis, you know, these white and black people in the movies, I thought that they were side to side. I thought that they identified themselves as Americans, and you know, within the first 2 years, to me, it was just trying to stay safe and not being shot at by the cops and trying to, you know, avoid all that problem. And then the election happened.
Oh, Lord.
Again, America had never been the same. It was just...
So,
yeah.
Going back to the book, because you mentioned how people were shorter than you thought they were, talk a little bit about your father, because early on, he had a life where he was kind of semi-famous because of his height and his prowess in basketball, and then things changed, and I felt so bad for him. Talk a little bit about the story of his life.
My dad was really a giant. He was very tall, and during his nomad days, as I describe in the book, he was a proud nomad. He made my mom, and some of the things he mentioned was that he could save the animals in her life from predators like the lions and hyenas. And then when he came to the city, thanks to his height and his strength, he ended up in one of the best, greatest jobs that you can do in Mogadishu at the time. He was not recruited into the army, so he was recruited into the basketball games. And he became famous because he could jump so high thanks to his nomad skills. Life has been very wonderful, even though I mean, I don't remember so much because I was only five when the happy days ended. And then right after that, 2 years later, catching up with him, you know, moving back to Mogadishu, he was completely someone else. And how my brother and I were supporting him, you know, cutting his hair, washing his clothes, and, you know, bringing him some water, and how he complained and had pain that was never going away. So for us, it was just, you know, that's what life looks like if there's a disaster that, you know, that could happen. So that happened to our family. No one ever thought that our famous dad would have ever been so weak and useless, but it had happened. And as you could probably, you know, in the book, I talk about our dad when he feels like guilty of all the money that he earned. He had not been paying so much attention to the faith and to God. And then he feels guilty, and he says, I wish, you know, all the money that I had saved, I think that God is punishing me because I haven't paid so much attention. You know? And then he was trying to save us by telling us to go to the mosque and telling us to go to the madrasa. And then it went crazy because my brother and I were not interested in doing all of that. I had my eyes on something else, and I was already inspired by America, and that hadn't made him so happy. So the how things are turned upside down was just crazy, you know, for our family. And eventually my dad gives up on us. And as I talk about a book, and he finds another wife and moves out and says, you know, the other kids that I will have will go to Madrasa and will follow my, you know, advice. And it's happening as we speak. He has two other kids who are really growing to be religious and you know, going to Madrasa. And one of them is already an assistant at the Madrasa. Very religious and have memorized the Quran the same way that I did, but they have followed, you know, the advice of my dad, and that's what they're doing.
Hey, talk a little bit. You know, first of all, you got bullets whizzing by you. You're seeing horrible things that I won't even talk about done to people. And then on top of everything else, every day having to find something to eat, having to risk your life with your brother, getting the water and all that. You still, on top of this is what really got me. You have the madrasa and this, what I consider horrible guy beating you, hanging you by your wrists. Talk a little bit about that, because that's in addition to all everything else you went through.
Right. I mean, you need to look at the Somali culture. You know, in Somalia, it does not matter what happens, but you have to know who you are. You know, identifying yourself by your religion and faith. So that is what Malim Basbas, you know, my madrasa teacher, and thousands of others like him had madrasas on every corner of the street, and that was the only school system that existed in Mogadishu, and you could only learn the Quran. So that's and you know, it doesn't matter what's happening. It does not matter if you do not eat for a whole week. You should better die sitting at the madrasa reading Quran, you know, than going to the movies or wandering on the streets. So that's one of the main purposes that the madrasas have been thriving very well, because the parents had a feeling that, you know, heaven was very close if you died or if you had lost your life walking towards the madrasa or walking from the madrasa or sitting in the madrasa reading Quran. So that's the Somalis, you know, because we're 100% Sunni Muslims, and there is no rejection or opposition to that, and that's one of the very important icons in our, you know, cultural system, where like a child who did not go to madrasa or hasn't memorized the Quran just is absolutely useless. I mean, you can be nothing. And the only ways out for you is the family disowns you, and then you can get recruited into the army and militias or, you know, everything else, and your life falls apart. So I was, we haven't eaten anything, and my brother and I had to go fetch some water going through sniper shots, you know, and we got shot, and bullets were hitting above our heads. And again, when we went to the madrasa with empty bellies, we got beaten so bad. But the beating was not, it was, you know, the teacher did not mean to beat us to just, you know, to make us hate him or to make us hate the Quran. But it was the opposite. It was one of the ways that you could memorize the Quran, you know, and that is a typical Somali, or at the time in Mogadishu, where you could feel like, oh, you know, this kid can be lazy and we don't want him to go to the movies and he won't accept advice. But the only way to do this is just to punish. So punishment was a way of teaching, was a way of guiding us into the right path. So that was what was happening. Man in Basbas, you know, or the madrasa beating us, Mom said, great, you know, that's it, it's working. And then I had blood all over my body with empty belly, and then I had to go get some water. It's hard to describe, but it was extremely painful. It was, you know, if I had wings, I would fly out and never come back. I did not have the authority to give up and not go it again. It was so hard because I could, you know, I could be disowned, and my family would hate me, and again, I was so small. So the madrasa teacher, even if I dropped out, he could come find me and drag me back to the madrasa. So there was no escape, and that was the only fact and reality that I had to accept. I mean, unfortunately, it's not only me. It's just, you know, it's like everywhere. And but what happens is when the madrasa ends, all the lessons, you know, come to a conclusion. I would say over 90% of the graduates just go one way, which is to follow and do things that, you know, our parents or the teacher and everyone else wanted us to do, which is like, you know, grow your beard, become a man, and wear this, you know, typical Islamic dress, and preach the word, and spread it, and die while you're doing that. Don't ever return from where you are. So to me, the most scary thing was, once you get to that level, once you, you know, wear that dress, and you start preaching the word, there was no return. That's exactly what happened in 2006 when Islamists ran over Somalia. You know, once they train you and once they brainwash you, there was no way back. You're just moving forward, and the only way ahead was death. You either have to kill or you have to be killed. What? I have avoided all that by defying the orders of my parents, staying out of the house, and, you know, graduating and going straight to the movies. So honestly, but thanks to movies, that was the only way, you know, the only source of survival for me. It gave me some dreams, it gave me some hope. And I had seen the world beyond Somalia, and I just wanted to experience that life.
Well, how did it end up happening, skipping ahead a little bit, how did it end up happening that you ended up in communication with the people at This American Life and other American media prior to your really lucky chance of winning the lottery? How did you first start communicating with them before all this other great stuff happened?
So I think it was 2008 when a very, very bad, I would say, like, it was Aleppo, right, in Syria. Like, a war was happening in Mogadishu, and the city had been leveled to the ground. You know, it was so hard to see buildings standing up. But then there was this American journalist, and now a National Geographic fellow, and his name is Paul Salopek. He was working for the Chicago Tribune at the time. He shows up in Mogadishu, surprisingly. And I was perfect. And it was, you know, in the middle of the day, and I had been walking around with dusty feet and all that, and I saw him taking pictures, a white guy taking pictures on the balcony of one of the buildings, heavily guarded by militias, and this is a time when Islamists were pushed out of the city by the Ethiopian troops. I waved at him, and I said, hello. I spoke English for the first time, 101, with an American. And he came down and pushed through the bodyguards who had all their AK-47 aimed at me. And he said, come on in. Exactly, that was the moment when, you know, when my life had a crack to the to making friends in the United States. Paul had written a story about myself, and he posted it, published it, and he emailed friends that he had in the American media, and then that's how I ended up doing an audio diary with an American radio, and the first audio diary that I had sent from my room, completely destroyed by the bomb. That is when so many American audience, you know, started writing to the radio, and they said, oh my gosh, you know, we need to really save this young man. And one of those families were a family at the time from Vermont, the McDonald Parish family, and now moved to Yarmouth, Maine, who actually sponsored me when I came to the United States. So they heard my story, and then they decided to step in and do something. And that's how it all started.
Yeah, but it's funny, though, because I thought when I was reading the book, I thought, okay, this is going to be his way out. these Americans are going to actually get him out of there. I didn't realize at the time, till I read further in the book, that they couldn't do that. It still required an incredible amount of luck. I was thinking, oh, they'll just pull him out. They're Americans. They can do anything. I didn't realize that you still had a long road to take, even though you were communicating with us.
It's very true. I mean, you have to know that since 2001, you know, 9/11, Somalia had been called a terrorist safe haven. So it was young men who were coming from there under the under 20s and all that. It was just extremely dangerous to get someone of my age and myself, like myself, into the United States. So to me, I had not only faced one problem, it was billions of problems trying to go to the United States because I do not have a family member. Most of the times when the U.S. State Department is trying to reconsider your case, they just look at your contacts in the U.S. and you must have at least a father and mother or something like that that can make it easier for them to accept your case. But in my case, I was just a refugee.
I know.
Out of Somalia and ran away from Somalia at a time when the Islamists were just taking over, and the State Department was not probably listening to my story, and they don't know exactly what happened and my love for America and how I taught myself English and all that. So that's very true. The Americans couldn't do anything. I applied to U.S. college twice. I get accepted at the college, but I've never been given the visa. And the last time, the visa officer told me, "Oh man, I mean, you're wasting your time because this is a non-immigrant visa, and it means you are a refugee. So how are you gonna ever want to come back to Somalia or Kenya? That's not going to happen, so don't waste your time." And at some point he was right, because I was a refugee in Kenya. And a non-immigrant or a student visa actually means you have to return once you're done with your education. And my American friends had been trying everything, but it seemed like all doors were closed, and they were quiet for a few months, and they had been sending us $100, $200 whenever we had to pay bribes to the police. And then when I won the lottery and I sent an email to my friends, and they just, to them, they were like, "Wait, what are you talking about?" They had no idea this program ever existed. And they started, this is the Team Abdi, you know.
Right.
Started, you know, Googling and finding out about something called Diversity Visa Lottery, and then they realized, whoa, it's real. It brings about 50,000 people to the United States every year. And then they said, "Whoa, yeah, you know, let's move on with this and let's do whatever we can." They raised money, they put together wonderful support letters and sent it to the embassy and all of this. It had not worked. It was so hard, you know. So, oh my gosh, I'm talking to you right now. I remember specifically what I was wearing and when I, you know.
Huh.
And how I could ever make. I mean, my brother, who I was living with in Nairobi at the time, he said, "Abdi, this is not going to work because the police are hunting us. We're getting deported back to Somalia, and you're trying to get out and get a police letter from the Kenyan police and all that, and the embassy is not going to give you a visa until you do that." And I said, "Nope, you know, I had fought enough, and I think I still have to fight. I don't have to give up. You know, this is, I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. I'm not going to give up here, man. I keep moving." So it was, how can I describe this? It was extremely courageous to, you know, be stuck in our apartment for 3 months, not even able to buy food outside of the apartment because the police were everywhere. But then I still tried to sneak out and get into the bus, and the Kenyans were not friendly with the Somalis, and they thought we were going to blow up. They all thought we were terrorists, you know. And the day when they asked me to, when they said that I had a bomb in my backpack, I mean, you know, that's when I really say thanks because I'm in Maine, and nobody's not is doing that to me. I mean, all the few complaints that I have here and being called an immigrant, a refugee, and all that, it just means nothing compared to the life-threatening events that I had in my life.
How do you how do you keep in contact with your family members, your friends, the people you knew back then? Are you still able to do that?
I am still able to do that. It's hard to call my mother because she does not have internet and she's still in Mogadishu. I send $450 every month. And I sent $450 two days ago, you know, at the end of every month. So she has some sort of a cell phone that does not have internet or camera or anything. So to me, to call her, I have to put $20 in my phone.
Wow.
And I told her, Mom, let me call you. Don't ever call me. And the reason I said that, it scares me when I receive a call from her, because every day as we speak, bombs explode, people get killed, militias are roaming the streets. Mogadishu is pretty much the same. Someone has been shot last night, and when I talked to her this morning, and she said, I know him. And that's why I'm saying I can never get up from these nightmares. It's just continuing as long as my family is in the middle of this madness, in the middle of these nightmares that I have, and that, you know, the real life that I lived years ago. So that's why I said, let me call you. Don't ever call me, Mom, because it scares me. You know, once you call me, I have heart attacks. Sometimes I'm driving and I see Mom calling, and I shake, you know, I shake when I'm picking up, because she might say, oh my gosh, Abdi, you know, everyone just died. And I'm serious.
Who else do you keep in contact with then, besides your mom?
My sister, who is still living with my mother, and her kids are now growing up. The oldest is 7. Oh my gosh. And I honestly, believe me, the friends, all the friends that I had in Mogadishu, made their way out of Somalia into Sudan, through the desert, into Libya, through the Mediterranean, into Europe. So they have all really taken this really extremely dangerous adventure that you can see and hear about today on the media, you know, about the Italians receiving thousands of refugees. So that's what happened to all the friends that that are in the book that I talked about.
That's
they made
amazing.
Their way to Europe, but unfortunately, they're not going to be accepted as permanent residents, and they're so disappointed. And sometimes, if I can, I financially support them. You know, sending $20 to them can also help them buy some food. So it's extremely difficult. But that's the only, you know, people that I, Mogadishu is never the same. My mom's there, my sister's there, but it feels like everyone else that I knew from my childhood, they're all gone, either died or made their way to these other countries.
Yeah, it seems like you were so close to your brother, it must have been so difficult. And you made a good team, you know, especially a lot of the tasks that you did to keep your mom and your sister going, and with such danger, and it seemed like you really were close and you made a good team. That must be really difficult for you.
It is very, very difficult for me. I still have some energy and I can do so much. My brother Hassan had, you know, I just talked to him because he's in Kenya, he has internet and we're able to speak every night, and he says he's running out of energy and he just got married and has his own twins, and he says he feels like our dad. You know, he feels like,
yeah.
Oh man, you know, the hustling is real. I never thought I would be in this position, but here I am, you know, still called refugee. He does not have a real nationality, to be honest with you, because he never had a Somali birthday or Somali passport, and now he has a refugee ID in Kenya for 16 years. That's as long as he has been in Kenya, and he hasn't received anything. And
wow.
Thank God, I have a green card, and I received my green card within a week when I came to the United States. So that's the difference. My nickname, Abdi the American, is becoming my nationality. I'm going to be American in a year or so, and I really can't wait for that time. And I just smile telling him all that. And then again, I frown, remembering, oh my gosh, my brother's been there for 16 years now, and all that. It's just, it's, you know, so I would say it's bittersweet. You know, it's bitter because it's all this, I just watched myself and how I have made it to the U.S. and I don't have to complain about anything at all now because of the past. And now looking at my family and they're still stuck.
Yeah, it really is such a long journey because, you know, the book begins and wonderfully about the fact that, you know, you didn't have a birthday. It wasn't important to measure the time from when you were born. And you were nomads, and the life you lived was measured by the number of animals you had, and again, how your father told your mother that he would protect her. And then you think of that culture. You speak of culture shock. It's an amazing... I don't know how you can even wrap your head around what's happened in your life from being a little boy in a situation where you didn't even know, like I said, your birthday, to being in cosmopolitan America. It's almost, it almost seems like I would have, I don't know how I would be able to wrap my head around the concepts that you have.
I know. It's that, those are still things that America, you know, amazes me. It's everyone really respects birthdays. And I remember my first birthday in 2015, and because I picked June 20th, you know, just randomly for it's like June 20th. It feels like the right thing. And when friends and families, you know, this family, the white people that adopted me and all that, had put together a huge birthday cake for me. I was sitting there at the table and watched everyone, you know, chant happy birthday to you, happy birthday. It's like, wow, it's happening. You know, it's like one of those turning points in my life, saying like, it's really, really happening. It's not a movie anymore. This is really happening. And I had tears in my eyes, and I had to wake up before I blew the candle, and I hugged everyone. I said, thank you guys. This really is happening, you know?
Yeah, it's so amazing because, you know, I think that they might very well make, maybe you already know, that they might make a movie out of your life and this story, but it's almost too difficult because it's almost too difficult to believe, even for a movie. And you know, you think back to the movies you watched, like Bruce Willis movies, where things you have to kind of, you know, suspend your disbelief to understand what's happening, but your life is more strange and miraculous than most movies could ever be, but I think it would make a good movie.
I want to tell the audience that we have, we're writing the script for a movie. We already have a movie deal.
Cool.
Out of the book, yes. So, and there's going to be a movie, and that's really, really wonderful news. We are working on that. And yes, you know, it's, you know, when I'm writing, I'm still working on the script, but to me, it's just like, where should I start? You know, there's so much, you know, great things, very disturbing things, you know, so many things happening in my life. So, yeah, I just wanted to let that out and say, like, yeah, we have a movie that we're working on about my story out of the Call Me American.
Yeah, it's like almost like you don't really have to change much to make it a wonderful story. I mean, anyway, I want to thank you, Abdi, for being with us today. It's been wonderful talking to you. And I'm glad you said that about the movie because I'm glad people will know about it now. And I have an independent bookstore that I own. And when your book came out, you know, I displayed it right on the front table, and I think it's going to do very well. So I really appreciate you talking to us today, and I really admire you a great deal.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Likewise. Okay, talk to you soon.
Talk to you. Bye-bye.
We were talking with Abdi Noor Iftan with regard to his new book just published last week, Call Me American. And it's a memoir, but it's a story that's really, really difficult to even believe. But he explained it very well. And the amazing thing is that he speaks English better than I do. And he learned it all from watching Arnold Schwarzenegger and Bruce Willis and Sylvester Stallone in their movies on a tiny TV in a tiny hut. He's an extremely intelligent guy, also an extremely lucky guy. What's also fascinating is he was able to hook up with NPR and be on This American Life and some other NPR programs before he even won the lottery. So I thought when I was reading the book that, you know, he was pulled out by Americans from American media, but that's not what happened at all. What happened was he was one of 50,000 out of millions of people who tried to get into America and just happened to win. And as he said, the rest of his family, his brother, his mom, his sister, are still back there dodging bullets every day and living in a world that's alien to all of us. But I'm glad it's being made into a movie. It'll be a good movie. And it's a fascinating story. And as I said to him, I really admire him. So I think this was a really good one. And that's why I'm glad that you guys join us every week on The Avid Reader. For a complete schedule, because there's so many people coming up. Rebecca's really lined up a good group of people that we'll be talking to in the near future, some of whom will probably go on to win the National Book Award or be the Indie Next, on the cover of the Indie Next, which is Independent Bookstore Association. And, yeah, I really love doing it, and I really love talking to these authors either after they become legends or before they have, and Rebecca finds someone who is going to become one. So thanks again, and I look forward to having you back here next week on The Avid Reader.